morning, I let all the personnel know of my planned retirement.
Just 18 months into the job, Anchorage Police Chief Chris Tully steps down. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, we check in on Juneau, where a stalemate over the budget continues in the legislature.
I've heard legislators put it, the two sides are sort of staring each other down, hoping that the other one flinches.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
At a press conference today, Anchorage's Police Chief Chris Tully announced he's stepping down.
This morning, I let all the personnel know of my planned retirement.
Tully took over APD in October of 2015 after a long career with the Drug Enforcement Administration. Coming from outside the department, he was tasked with growing the number of officers and improving morale for a staff that had been reduced under the last administration.
It was very, very trying times, which because of the numbers of officers on the streets, it meant everybody was being worked harder and harder. And the value of worth and their productivity made them feel, you know, not real good about themselves.
Tully and the current municipality administration thinks the department has turned a corner. With increased funding and additional police academies, the size of the force is now slightly above the city's target of 400 sworn officers. And Mayor Ethan Berkowitz says APD is pivoting away from a rebuilding phase.
And one of the things that Chris Tully and I wanted to do was make sure that the next chief would come from the ranks of current APD personnel. And because we were able to spend these last 2 years cultivating and building that kind of internal leadership, it's my pleasure to announce the next police chief for the municipality of Anchorage will be Captain Justin Dahl.
Captain Dahl is a 20-year veteran of the department who's worked in a variety of positions, from a motorcycle officer to a bomb technician, and most recently as the head of crime suppression. The division handles many of the police department's community-facing functions, like 911 dispatch and police academy recruitment. Mayor Ethan Berkowitz campaigned on a platform of improving public safety through community policing, a somewhat vague set of policies that's been overshadowed as police and officials have struggled to handle 2 years of worsening violent crime. Dahl says with more officers in the pipeline, the department will begin trying new policing techniques.
With another academy graduating in June, the department's really poised to start doing great things. We're looking forward to that, implementing innovative police strategies and really reaching out to the community, things like foot patrol and officers on bicycles.
Dahl formally takes over from Tully on June 30th. The legislature appears to be stuck. The House and Senate haven't named members to the conference committees that would meet to resolve the two chambers' differences. Until that happens, the fate of the state's budget remains uncertain. To discuss this, Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman joins me from Juneau. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Lori.
So, Andrew, what's going on? What's happening in the Capitol this week?
Well, it should be a little busier this week than last week. It does look like we're going to have another slow week in front of us. There are a couple very significant bills that are being looked at. The Senate Resources Committee is making significant changes to the oil and gas tax overhaul. And the bill that the House passed that would reinstitute an income tax in Alaska for the first time in 37 years is scheduled for public testimony on Tuesday evening. So in particular, what remains to be seen is how the House and Senate will go about negotiating compromises related to the budget and the future of the budget for years beyond this year.
Are there differences between how the Senate and the House are approaching the session now that the legislature passed the scheduled end last week?
Yes, definitely. The Senate wants a more limited agenda. They have about 17 bills, which sounds like a lot, but actually a lot of them are really pretty focused on the budget. There's a few that are of particular interest to particular senators. They feel that the more the legislature's focused on the biggest issues, this will help in getting things done quicker. The House has a really different perspective. The House majority feels that all of the committees can continue to do their work while the conference committees, which haven't been named yet and haven't gotten started yet, but once we have conference committees, they say there's only going to be a few legislators who are going to be on the conference committees, so the rest of the legislators can continue to meet in their own committees and be productive while they're in Juneau. There have been differences already between how the two chambers have been working throughout the session. The House has passed about twice as many bills. They have about 47, and the Senate has passed 24.
So that's interesting. Do you have a sense as to why the House has passed more bills?
Well, the idea I have is that it's the first time in 24 years that there's a Democratic Speaker of the House. And so House members who were previously in the minority see a new opportunity to pass legislation. Meanwhile, the Senate majority is fairly similar to the majority last year, so they haven't pent up as much demand to pass bills.
Why haven't any conference committees gotten started?
I've heard legislators put it, the two sides are sort of staring each other down, hoping that the other one flinches. This issue actually came up today on the House floor when House Minority Whip and former Speaker Mike Chenault cited the rules to say that the House majority should name members to a conference committee. And that would be a committee on the bill that would make changes to permanent fund earnings and reduce the permanent fund dividends. Here's Chenault addressing House Speaker Bryce Edgeman.
Mr. Speaker, if there's a reason or a strategy why the majority is waiting to name the conference committee for Senate Bill 26, the minority in this body and the public deserve a sound reason as to why conferees are not being named.
Chenault decided against pushing any further, and Edgeman didn't publicly address the point. But House Rules Chairwoman Gabrielle Ledoux pointed out that the Senate majority hasn't named members to a conference committee on the budget. So we have two different conference committees, one on the permanent fund bill, the other on the budget. The House minority, Republican House minority, is blaming the House majority for not getting going on this permanent fund bill. But the House majority is pushing back on that and saying, hey, the Senate hasn't gotten going on having a conference committee on the budget, and that's what's most important. And you'll hear that in this clip from Gabrielle Ledoux.
So we are waiting, and thank you, Mr. Former Speaker, for pointing that out. Thank you.
So for now, neither side wants to give any ground.
That was Andrew Kitchenman reporting from Juneau. The climbing season on Denali has already yielded its first successful summit for two climbers. Forrest Barker and Connor Chilcote of Seattle reached the highest point in North America on Sunday, April 16th. Mid-April is early in the climbing season for a group to make it to the summit of Denali and back, but the early ascent came with some difficulties. Barker and Chilcote were forced to overnight high on the mountain in windy conditions with temperatures dipping past 40 degrees below zero. They were picked up and flown back to Talkeetna last Friday. The high elevation and cold temperatures resulted in frostbite on one toe for Connor Chilcote and a high-altitude pulmonary edema for Forrest Barker. Neither condition is uncommon on Denali, and both men say they expect to recover fully. Public health workers may have turned the corner on an outbreak of Group A streptococcus in Anchorage and Fairbanks that has killed five people and caused others to undergo amputations.
We're seeing some really promising decline in the case counts.
Emily Mositis is an epidemic intelligence officer for the CDC based in Anchorage. She says the outbreak was first detected in Fairbanks, where it killed two people in March of last year. Then it moved to Anchorage. The vast majority of cases were in the homeless population.
Between October and January, we were seeing about two cases of severe disease per week, which was high.
Group A strep is the bacteria that causes strep throat. Infections become severe when they invade the blood or other areas that don't normally have bacteria. Those cases are more likely in people with compromised immune systems. Mositis says the strain in this outbreak has been identified as M26.3.
It has been identified in the Middle East, in Kenya, and in New Zealand. So a couple places throughout the world. It was brand new to Alaska.
She says it was the combination, a slightly more destructive strain in a vulnerable population, that made the outbreak so serious. Some of the five deaths were from toxic shock syndrome and others from necrotizing fasciitis, where the infection kills soft tissue. Mosaitis says several Alaskans survived after amputations.
We have had a few people who have lost fingers and toes from this, and we've had someone lose an arm and someone lose a leg.
Public health workers at first tried a targeted approach aimed at close contacts of people who became sick. Case counts didn't drop as expected, so they launched a broad intervention. Over a few days in mid-February, they offered a single dose of antibiotic to anyone seeking help at the Brother Francis Shelter and other places that serve the homeless. About 400 people agreed to take the pills. Mosaita says the number of new cases dropped dramatically to about 2 per month. She credits a united effort between the service agencies and all 3 local hospitals.
They offered volunteers and time, and if we hadn't had them as partners, and if we hadn't been working with the state and the municipality of Anchorage, I don't think we would have seen the decline that we did.
Mosaita says they haven't eliminated the bacteria from the population, so they do expect more cases, but they'll be on alert for any increase. University of Alaska campuses are bracing for change as UA faces up to $22 million in cuts from the state. University administration is entertaining several different long-term options to reduce the UA's costs, which it is calling strategic pathways. Some of the options could have profound effects on higher education in rural Alaska. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
Vivian Beyer is the assistant director of the Bristol Bay campus in Dillingham.
The purpose of strategic pathways is to give the president options of how to proceed with the budget cuts that are coming. There are 6 avenues that strategic pathways list. The community campuses are leaning toward is option 6, which is just increased collaboration among the other community colleges in Alaska. However, the president is leaning toward the learning center option, unfortunately.
Beyer says that option would decrease education opportunities in the region dramatically.
A learning center is basically a computer center where students can come, use the computers, use the internet, perhaps get a little bit of tutoring. But as for taking classes on campus, that is not an option. That's not what a learning center is. It would be devastating. We service so many villages, flying students in, flying instructors out, providing student service support, offering classes, all of that pretty much would go away.
In addition to decreased state funding, community campuses like Bristol Bay's would no longer be eligible for the significant federal grant funds that they receive.
Currently, we have approximately $7 million in federal funding that serves our villages in the Aleutian-Pribilof region. The state funding level would drop dramatically as we would not have the staff and the resources that we needed that is paid by the state funding.
University President Jim Johnson held a mid-April press conference after a special meeting with the Board of Regents to discuss contingency plans and preparations for the fiscal year 2018. Johnson discussed both e-learning and increased collaboration as possible immediate contingency options for rural campuses.
So I think more e-learning, more online technology will be part of the solution there in our community campuses. Another thing that I think is a real opportunity is sharing among the community campuses. The directors of our community campuses meet regularly. They work together on new program development. So instead of 3 or 4 of the campuses developing a new program in a certain field, they'll say, hey, the Bristol Bay campus has already done that. We can expand this thing to include your students.
The Board of Regents will meet in May for an update on how the state budget will affect the university's budget, and again in June to discuss strategic pathways and the school budget for the next fiscal year. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaskans show support for science in marches across the state.
I'm a cancer survivor, and I truly believe that science saved my life.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Thousands of Alaskans participated in the March for Science across the state on Saturday. About 2,000 people attended the march in Anchorage, carrying signs addressing everything from scientific contributions to medicine to the impacts of climate change. Chris Blake is a mental health clinician who says he uses science daily when diagnosing people and developing treatment plans, but his reason for marching was more personal.
I'm a cancer survivor, and I truly believe that science saved my life. If it hadn't been for chemotherapy and doctors that knew what they were doing and surgery and meds, then, I wouldn't be here today.
Teresa Soli was the lead in putting together the March for Science in Juneau. Soli thinks people came out to march because they're frustrated with politics in Washington, D.C.
No climate scientist wants to hear from a president or an administration that doesn't believe in climate science. We watch the glaciers melt. It's no secret. I think that a lot of people with strong backgrounds in science are really quite concerned.
But Soli says the march wasn't only about climate change.
Standing for science is supporting healthcare. It's supporting education of the sciences. It's supporting transparent data. It's supporting science communication.
Other marchers talked about the need for science to be the basis for policymaking and the importance of funding scientific research. The University of Alaska Anchorage is in the final stages of starting a new program that focuses on positions that assist doctors during surgery. It's called the Surgical Technology Program, and as Alaska Public Media's Josh Edge reports, the curriculum will train students for difficult-to-fill positions in the state's healthcare industry.
At a time of fiscal uncertainty, when much of the University of Alaska is trimming down, UIA is gaining a program. Robin Watto is the director of UIA's School of Allied Health. She says the Surgical Technology Program was created in response to industry need.
Many of the larger institutions are currently hiring folks from outside to move to Alaska to fill those positions. So we obviously want to be able to help fill some of those positions with people who are here in Alaska.
Surgical technologists assist surgeons in a variety of ways, including preparing the operating room and ensuring equipment is working properly and by maintaining a sterile operating environment. A survey by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development estimates the need for surgical technologists to grow 13% by 2024. Watto says the program, which the UA Board of Regents approved in March, is going to start small.
We want to make sure that we are producing the number of students that will be able to find employment. So we feel as though 12 is a really safe number to start with, both in order to make sure our students are having an excellent experience in their practicum, and also to make sure that those students are able to find jobs at the completion.
The university recently hired an additional faculty member who is a certified surgical technician. Graduates of the program will earn an associate's degree in surgical technology. For now, the entire program will be based in Anchorage, but Watto hopes it can expand to other parts of the state that are in need of surgical technologists.
If there's a student from one of those communities, we hope that eventually they would be able to do at least part of their practicum back in their home community, which also, increases their chances probably of being able to maybe perhaps continue to work there after their practicum is completed.
UAA is still awaiting official approval from the Northwest Commission on Colleges and Universities, but expects it to come through before June 15th, at which point students can be admitted into the program. Several industry groups donated money to help fund the program, including Providence Alaska Medical Center, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, and Alaska Regional Hospital. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
It's going to cost to access some interior state park facilities where it was free in the past. Alaska State Parks Northern Region Superintendent Brooks Ludwig says user fees are being added at 14 Fairbanks area sites.
Any area that has infrastructure, parking, and access to restrooms, we're going to go ahead and start charging a $5 day use fee at those sites.
The sites where fees are being added include 2 campgrounds, 3 trailheads, 2 river access points, 2 boat launches, and a shooting range in the Chena River State Recreation Area, as well as at Salcha, Clearwater, and Delta Recreation Sites and the Big Delta State Historical Park.
It'll be self-registration. We call them Iron Rangers. There'll be a sign with a metal box there with envelopes you take out and tear off the receipt, put it on the dash of your vehicle, put your $5 in, and put it back in the Iron Ranger.
Ludwig says the additional user fees are projected to yield about $28,000, a just under 10% revenue increase for the state park's northern region.
Alaska is in dire need of more money, so we're trying to do our part to be sustainable.
He notes that half of regional operating costs are covered by user fees. The new charges, which begin May 1st, come as Northern Region Parks face proposed budget cuts specifically targeting Delta area facilities.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Last year, Yukon River subsistence fishermen got their first chance to target king salmon since 2012. They could get another chance this year, as preseason projections for the 2017 Yukon King Run suggest a slight improvement over last year. As KIYU's Tim Bedoni reports, a project that studies young salmon as they are heading out to sea is helping managers get a clearer picture of future salmon runs.
Since 2003, Dr. Katie Howard from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and her crew of researchers have operated small mesh trawl surveys in between St. Lawrence Island and the Yukon Delta, catching several hundred young salmon of various species. Through genetic testing, researchers are able to determine where the fish are from. Most juvenile salmon caught are just emerging from the rivers to spend their first winter at sea, and most come from the Yukon River drainage. Howard reports that the offshore sampling project has measured an increased abundance of juvenile Yukon River king salmon since 2013, and that bodes well for king returns starting this summer.
Those fish that we first saw in 2013, those should be coming back to the river as six-year-old fish this year. And so we're expecting approximately between 90,000 and 130,000 Canadian origin Chinook to the Yukon.
Using the juvenile offshore sampling data, Howard has been able to generate a king salmon run forecast for each run since 2013, and the actual runs have fallen within the range of her predictions each year except 2015. Howard explains that her run predictions seem to be working well because they gather data at a critical point in the life cycle of a salmon.
It's at a point that's after whatever it is that's happening that's causing good abundance versus bad abundance is occurring.
Department of Fish and Game Yukon River summer season manager Holly Carroll says that the juvenile sampling data helps fine-tune the traditional forecast derived from escapement estimates, which might predict a fairly wide range of potential outcomes.
The last few years, the juvenile forecast has kind of come in a little higher than our forecast. And that just sort of tells us that it's a good indication that we may be looking at seeing the upper end of our forecast range.
Though she's encouraged by the upward trend that the juvenile sampling project is suggesting for the next few Yukon King runs, Carroll remains cautious and doesn't want to reorient the official run forecast upwards.
It just kind of keeps people remembering that these runs are still half the size they used to be, that we are still in conservation mode, and while there may be just a little bit of subsistence harvest, we're not out of the woods yet.
This year, subsistence fishermen on the Yukon should expect a similar management strategy as last year, according to Carroll. That means that king fishing will be prohibited during the early part of the run. If the king run comes back as strongly as anticipated, then Fish and Game would allow for retention of kings later in the run and possibly schedule directed openings for kings using 7.5-inch mesh nets. In Galena, this is Tim Bedoni.
Winter is more or less over in most of Alaska, and if you like that kind of thing, winter that is, it was pretty decent in much of the state. But climatologist Brian Brettschneider with our Ask a Climatologist segment says, don't get used to it. Brett Schneider says normal winter was a sweet spot of cold in a much larger bubble of warm.
Normal is the new below normal. So it felt, a lot of people commented to me, it felt like it was a really cold winter, that, you know, extended cold periods. But it really was just slightly below normal for most of the state. But because of the record warm winters we've experienced the last few years, it really did feel quite a bit colder. So it's much more typical Alaska winter this year.
So really, yeah, normal winter in the biggest cities. But then if you get very far north in the state, it just is bizarre, right? Bizarrely warm.
Yeah. So, you know, part of what's going on in the northern third of the state is the proximity to warm, open water that's typically covered by sea ice. So this year it took a long time for the winter sea ice to move in on the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas and the Bering Sea. And for that time period, it released a lot of warmth into the atmosphere. And so the entire Arctic ocean basin experienced by far their warmest November through March period on record. And so those areas that were in the closest proximity to the Arctic Ocean also carried that extra warmth through the entire winter season.
So in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau, did we basically just get lucky with winter?
We really did. If you look at the entire Northern Hemisphere or the entire globe, that period was the second warmest on record. But if you look at the distribution of temperatures, we really were right in a sweet spot of having what felt like a normal winter, where we were kind of surrounded by exceptional warmth. I mean, all of northern Russia, record warm, much of the lower 48, record warm. You know, we were just kind of in one little spot. And our perspective is, you know, it seemed like everything is kind of back to the way it used to be. But that's just our, from our local point of view, it looks that way. But the big picture is it was exceptional warmth is continuing.
It's so depressing. I mean, should we not expect to have good winters like this one in Alaska in the future?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, it's hard to project, you know, even a few months out, much less many years out. But given the increasing baseline temperatures, it stands to reason that winters will be warmer for the foreseeable future. On average, we can still have below normal temperatures. I mean, in January 2012, I believe, was the coldest month on record in Alaska. But that is the exception and not the rule. So you can still have exceptions. This winter, I think, unfortunately, is going to be an exception. And when we look back in a few years, we'll kind of remember fondly that was a really cold winter, even though it turned out to be pretty normal.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate and climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Avery Lill in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Tim Bodoni in Galena, and Annie Feit, Zachariah Hughes, Liz Ruskin, Ann Hillman, and Josh Edge in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.